The podcast you're about to hear is made possible thanks to the generous supporters of patreon.com/Ian Bolesworth and patreon.com/burials and beyond. If you enjoy this podcast and you'd like to contribute and you'd like to get involved, there's tons of other content on both patrons as well, then please consider coming joining and helping the project along. Thank you. Hello and welcome to Loopholes, your weekly discussion podcast on all things esoterotic. My name is Ian Bolesworth. Hello.
And my name is Kate Cheryl. Hello.
And Kate will be fulfilling two roles today. She'll be not only a very, very insightful, intelligent, smart contributor to this podcast, as indeed I hope to be myself, but she will also be in charge of admin, because I, Ian Bolesworth, haven't charged my iPad. My iPad is completely flat. And I just realised that the comments will be on my iPad, so I wanted to read them. So Kate is going to be reading all the comments today, including the ones from my Patreon, which she is going to log into now and have a little look at them.
Okay, right. Well, you know, I knew I'd end up being a secretary eventually.
My bad. Okay. What's happened is I've made my house into a smart house.
You have, as you've been showing off relentlessly today.
I've got used to doing nothing. So I've got used to just sitting in my chair and just shouting at things, which means that I genuinely think this is what's happened.
Yeah.
I've not plugged my phone in. I've not plugged my iPad in enough. I've not charged things up. Things that I have to do manually, I've just not done.
Yeah. Too futuristic.
It's like Tron. It's like Tron at my house. So, Kate, let's get to the comments, which you will be solely in charge of today. I'll respond. I don't think there's that many, in fairness. There's not as many as usual. So I'll respond, and you can read them all out. You're a better reader than me, anyway.
Right. Now, as per tradition, shall we start with yours?
You can pretend that all these comments are to you if you want. I've had no comments on my Patreon this week. None at all.
Yeah.
Have you had comments on your Patreon, Kate?
Oh, tons, mate.
Let's just do that. Just read out all your comments then.
Right, okay, great. Well, Andy Walker said that we should probably have a Randy episode, because he deserves one, just of his own.
I would agree with that as well. But interestingly today, Andy Walker, no spoilers, but I'll give you a little hint as what's to come. We are having a Randy episode today.
Hey. And Callum McCarthy says, the lady that used to work in Greg's, this was the demonologist who quit her job at the bakery to open the gates of hell 5 or 6 times a day.
Yeah.
She should probably go to the doctors, because he used to open the gates of hell 3 or 4 times a day, and he had to drop his pants and get an examination for that. Brackets.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I understand that.
Filthy, Callum. No. Filthy boy. We'll have none of that in this podcast.
No, there's always room for a bit of fun like that. I've thought about it a lot more, you know, this week, as I tend to do. As I've said before, I think about it in the edit, when I'm editing.
Yeah.
Because I'm listening quite carefully to what we're saying. I do think about stuff more than I even thought about in the episode itself. And I think there was a clarification that I think was there, but I'd quite like to hammer it home, that it wasn't a condemnation of even a belief system or what have you. It was just that, you know, as in somebody believing in demons and all that sort of stuff. It was the idea that she thought she had the power as a human being to open the gates of hell. Even if we deign to believe that hell is a real concept, it's a real concept, it's a real thing. The idea that she was that powerful. So I guess there's a degree of delusion to that for me, you know, and to be honest with you, a delusion of grandeur, really, in that the idea that she'd be that powerful.
We see that a lot in the field of esotericism, isn't it?
Mm.
People trying to find their own self-importance somewhere, trying to find where they fit in and where they can thrive. And if they see that as offering a non-tangible service, then I suppose that's how they feel happy in themselves, which isn't necessarily the greatest method.
Well, it's horses for courses, whatever, you know, whatever floats your boat, I guess. But I was about to say, but that's a relatively harmless thing in most cases. But even as I was thinking that to say it, I thought, I'm not sure that it is. Again, from my own personal experience, without naming any names, there's people that I have certainly encountered within the esoterotic community and the esoterotic themed events and what have you, who I've always assessed as being people that this is their moment of attention, you know, that are otherwise potentially would be lonely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let me say, by the way, that I'm quite a lonely person myself, but I don't think as I get older, I don't think I have the same need for attention, but that may be because it's a constant in my life anyway, in terms of, you know, like previously I'd do stand-up and things, so you would get that attention, but I never felt that was a need, but it could be argued maybe that's what was going on. And now with Patreon and things, because I have a group of people who support me and, you know, purport to like my work and stuff, I guess that's just my base level. It's just there.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say that I don't need it, because maybe if that was taken away, I would find out that, oh, that was really important to me beyond just financial support. But I've always assessed the people that I've met, there've been a few of them, that they would be lost without it. Their quote-unquote expertise or quote-unquote abilities, you know, being able to do psychic stuff or what have you, are their raison d'etre, you know, that provides them with something in their life where they are, again, quote-unquote, important for a minute.
Yeah.
And part of me still does. I was always thinking, well, there's no harm in that. I'm glad that they do. I'm glad they have the little play thing where, you know, their mother or father hen or what have you. I don't mind that. But then if you just dig a bit deeper, particularly with psychic stuff as well, and you go, well, no, some of the things you said to me were really bad.
Yeah, for a hobby that's mainly going out in a group and doing X, Y, and Z, it's not as insular as maybe, you know, you'd anticipate when you first see ghost hunting and all that sort of thing from the outside, because there is always interaction with other people, or desired interaction with other people. And whether or not that takes the form of recording some big ritual and putting it on YouTube, or verbally abusing someone whose work you don't like at an event, or, you know, there's always going to be little tendrils from these things where I think people can get very, very carried away with themselves. And so really, no aspect of esotericism is truly safe, I think, or free from poison, really.
Widening that out, you do operate within that community.
I do, yeah.
You know, you write stuff within it, you've done television stuff within it, where you've done the things that they do. And it seems weird for me to say to you, they, but I think I do, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I do see a difference in you. I don't see you as them, even though the actual toys you're playing with and the opinions you're giving, there's a consistency with them.
I'm certainly, I don't want to ever, like, other myself.
I don't know what that, I've heard that a lot and I don't even know what that means. I've heard loads of people say that, other myself, and I don't know what that means.
Well, like, to other something, I suppose, there's probably a really snappy way of saying it, but to set someone aside from the norm, make them the odd one out, or the anomaly.
Right, okay.
You know, and I don't want to come across as being like, oh, darling, I'm not like you. Right. Being the pick me girl of the paranormal, because, you know, I'm really not.
Well, I'm not saying you're better than them. I never said
that. Oh, no. Oh, believe me, I'm sure of that. But I think because I'm so introspective.
Right.
And because, like you, you know, I spend a lot of time on my own. I suppose it's the nature of being a writer as well. You do spend a hell of a lot of time on your own. That then separates me, at least socially and sociologically, from people who are far more active and going out in groups. That's pretty understandable, I suppose, that I have a slightly more different worldview on the paranormal, because I do definitely interact with certain groups and movements and things like that, a bit like I'm just sat in an airport and people watching.
Okay.
I think I've got a certain sense of self-awareness of the whole thing, but I'm under no illusion that none of this is incredibly silly.
Right, okay.
You know, but I think with that, then I can still acknowledge the dangers of having esoteric or abnormal belief systems, I suppose.
What if we're dangerous loners? What if it turns out that we're dangerous loners, but we don't know? Because dangerous loners wouldn't know that they were, would they?
No, maybe.
I'm not going to shoot anyone or anything like that. Like that, you know, that's not in me to do that. What if we're dangerous loners? Maybe that's what they'll say as a rebuttal when we're talking or trying to be smart about it to the best of our abilities. Maybe their rebuttal will be, well, they're just dangerous loners.
Yeah.
I'd quite like a t-shirt with dangerous.
I was just thinking that. Like those Hell's Angels back patches.
I think I would like that. Yeah, so I guess that was the thing I was thinking during the edit, was that it was, it felt actually more serious than we actually addressed it as, you know, it felt like that's really, really weird behaviour to think you can open the gates of hell.
I suppose it's just the natural human want for control. It's controlling the uncontrollable. And no one can say you can't because they can't see it because they're closed-minded, etc.
Yes, yes, of course. And also the thing that we discussed about upping the ante, I suppose. Okay, yeah. Next comment, please.
Really great comment from Jamie Morse, who said that this is the first time they felt the need to write in because the believers in demonology genuinely frightened me. I've been approached in the street and told that I'm only transgender because I have a demon in me. A frightening thing to hear on a number of levels, but most of all because of the concern about what disagreeing with them could lead to. If someone confronts you as possessed and you take issue with them, does that make you a willing agent of Satan in their mind? Does that permit them to take action? There are all manner of people in the world, and where there is just disagreement between me and someone, I can work with that and discuss it. But anything where our differences as people can be put down to demons can only cause further division.
Well, yeah, it's the my reference point relating to that would be the witch trials again.
Yeah.
And that was, as we discussed last week, was just the general anti-women thing, I suppose, really.
Yeah.
So I guess thus it has always been, you know, I'm sorry that you went through that, and if that's an ongoing thing, it's an awful thing, isn't it? I mean, really, that would apply to just everything that isn't what the person accusing you of is. So if it's a bloke, you know, if you're a trans or if you're a woman, or if it's a straight person, if you were gay, or if it's a gay person, if you're straight, you know, they could, all those things, they could apply that to, well, you're not what I am, so you're not right.
Yeah, you don't fit into my strict worldview, which is usually religiously governed when it comes to kind of extreme claims of those sort of things.
But not exclusively, though. But oftentimes, there are people who just have an inherent prejudice in them.
Oh, of course. I was meaning more in terms of...
Who knows where that comes from?
Yeah, I was meaning more in terms of people who would actively go out and accost people on the street. They're generally religiously led. And obviously a twisted version of their religion that suits their own non-religious worldview and their own prejudices.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of people with inherent prejudice. It's got nothing to do with religion. It's just they don't like anything that isn't what they are.
Yeah.
Or people they know. If it's anything different to what they consider to be the norm because it is their norm,
yeah,
then they're all over it. But I guess I understand with Jamie that, it goes up a level then, doesn't it? It's not just someone not liking you because you're trans. It's actually then adding to that. And it is because you are possessed.
Yeah, how'd you get to that jump?
I think it's about wanting to punch harder. Like I do, yeah. It's vile, it's horrible, but I think it's about wanting to punch harder. So it's not enough for them to go, you pervert, or you're disgusting. You know, they need more, and you're possessed, something, you actually need actually treating with a cross or something. You're all possessed, you are.
Do you think...
You know what I mean? You've got a demon in you.
Do you think if demons are real, and they exist in the world and the land of the corporeal and the living, they'd be that interested in gender identity?
Well, who knows, because it's a good way to stir, isn't it? So, again, if we're adopting the fancy at the moment, if you look at the modern world, certainly in the world of the internet and social media and all that sort of thing, the most divisive thing is gender identity, definitely.
Yeah.
So, if there was a demon from hell...
Yeah.
Who wanted to go, how do I upset the apple cart the most? What would cause the most disruption?
More trans people who don't want to be bothered. Yes, that's how we'll take over the world, causing a mild irritant to people who want to get on with their lives.
You're shooting the messenger here. You're shooting the messenger. I'm one of the nice demons.
Oh, I know.
Saying is, if it's one that really does want to stir the pot and wants to cause as much divisiveness as possible, then what better subject to jump onto? Now, even by saying that, I don't want any credibility to be inferred in the actual original claim.
Oh, no.
Like, going, well, that's what they would do. Because I'm saying that. That's just a sort of side discussion, debate thing. Of course nobody has a demon in them. Of course they don't. Catchphrase alert. I don't believe in any of this anyway. So.
Yeah.
I'm mainly just kind of appalled that a human being has to put up with that sort of comment. Yeah. You know, it's just horrible. So, sorry,
it's
Jamie.
It's horrific, yeah.
God, I love that comment. That was a really, like, sort of insightful comment. I wish that had been on my Patreon and not yours.
I know.
I got none on my Patreon this week.
Yeah, well, I just... Yeah, you need to put more effort in, mate. So, lovely comments from Craig Harrison and Annette Truby, and Lewis Crawford Wilson says that he's listening to another podcast, very rude, where their agenda seems to be to promote that there is a haunting and a ghost, but even they wrote off demonology as kind of dangerous. I know it's something that Most Haunted moved into as well, and they had a resident demonologist. whose website I was on not long ago, actually.
What, nudes of you? Were they trying to bring you down?
Yeah. Spoilers. I have not been doxxed by a demonologist yet.
Okay. That's a good thing. So who is it? Who's the person?
The demonologist?
Yeah.
Is Fred Batt.
I beg your pardon, sorry.
Fred Batt?
Fred Batt.
Yeah.
Fred Batt.
Fred Batt. Yeah, he's a interesting bloke. Because he was the demon...
Hang on. Fred Batt, the demonologist.
Yeah, two T's. And he was like the resident demonologist on Most Haunted. But he also, as far as I know, is a nightclub owner.
Oh yeah, from Bat's Batty Nightclub. See that chap? Yeah. Do you know what? I've never seen an episode of Most Haunted. I've seen little bits of it.
Oh, you should never say that to me.
No, and I never will. I remember watching a live one that was at East Drive. I remember watching a chunk of that. But I've never watched from opening credits to close of credits, really? Ever.
Not even
I don't
any
know
of the,
much about it.
Not any of the celebrity ones?
No, I think Paul O'Grady was on the one that I saw that was at East Drive. But, I mean, this must be long before I started doing professional work that was related to esoterotica. Even though I was always interested in it, and even though I read about it, and even though I knew things about famous hauntings and had that interest going on, I always considered Most Haunted, perhaps unfairly, because as I say, I've never watched it properly.
Yeah.
I always considered that to be a silly programme. You know, that it would be impenetrable for someone who was actually thinking about it on a proper level, really. Maybe that's an arrogant way of talking about it, but that was my perception of it. But well, again, I must say, that's without actually have seen it. That was just what I presumed it was.
Well, I was obsessed with Most Haunted for quite a few years. And I check in every now and again because they do Most Haunted live on Facebook now. And they're very, very long live streams. They're like hours long. Whereas the original Most Haunteds were quite interesting. They kind of set the template, like the rudimentary template, for a lot of ghost shows today. You know, they had the historian, they had the psychic, they had, you know, later on the skeptic, the demonologist. They had this little team and that it was all filmed as though it was, you know, unedited, this is what happens.
So was there nothing in that format that preceded that? Was that actually an original format?
I'd honestly say that Most Haunted would be the seminal programme for the world of ghost hunting TV, certainly in the UK.
Including the stuff that you've done yourself?
Yeah, hugely impactful. I think a lot of my interests in esoterotica were certainly fanned by Most Haunted. You know, as mocked as it is as a format now, and as overdone as it arguably is as a format,
right,
its importance can't be overstated.
So is it unfair then in that respect? So what I've said about what my opinion was on it based on no knowledge, really, is my conclusion unfair? Have I not cut it enough slack in terms of what it is? Because we've all seen all the clips of, you know, Derek Acora, may he rest in peace, and all that, and all the daft stuff that went on there. Him saying stupid double entendres and all that sort of business.
Yeah.
And as I say, I saw a big chunk of the East Drive live one. But would you say my assessment of it is unfair then?
I think it's a little unfair. Because I think at times it could be really interesting. And again, if you're not believing that there's anything spooky going on, you can still take out some entertainment and some enjoyment from it.
Oh, I remember really laughing when there was a bald bloke on it who got hit by a set of keys. The set of keys that is still in East Drive, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that and them claiming they'd either flown across the room and hit him or whatever it was. I know what those keys are like. They would have, at worst, killed him dead.
Yeah.
But at least would have split his head open. At least there'd have been claret everywhere.
There's been quite a few people and personal friends of mine who were featured as like historians on Most Haunted, who have many tales of experience to tell from it. And I think those sort of stories, you know, when they increased in frequency, that kind of slowly brought down the interest, but also it ran for countless series.
Yeah, not much can run that long and not lose quality in some way.
Yeah.
Or certainly, even if it doesn't lose quality, certainly get a bit samey. But we've got away from the demonologist.
We have. We've got away from Fred Bat. Well, Lewis said that he met him
once
and he seemed ridiculous, and he was wearing a big cross and claiming that a building across the road from where I worked needed exercising. It was just an old building and no one had ever mentioned a demon before.
Yeah, but what you're not taking into account, Lewis, is he's a demonologist, mate. He'll be seeing things that you won't see. He's got a big cross. His name's Bat, for heaven's sake. You've got to put some credence in what he's saying.
But it's okay, because Paul Kenny is going to become a demonologist for 28 quid. He says, brilliant, I'm going to do it.
So let
us know if you get any magical powers, please, Paul. So if we go over to my comments, not that all of those weren't mine, we're just keeping consistent.
Yeah, we understand.
Callum McCarthy said that an ex of mine, who was a goth, once tried to engage with a local group who called themselves demonologists, but she was immediately turned away and insulted due to the fact that she was, quote, just a young girl that didn't know what she was getting into. Even though she was in her 20s and just finishing uni. It seems from the outside like ghost bothering and these fields are massively male dominated and hostile to the idea of women getting involved in their hobby. And he said, my favourite bit is, I'm sorry if I just repeated what you guys were talking about here. I'm tired and on my lunch break at work.
That's okay. Like, again, we've talked about this a fair bit. And I think I've asked you a similar question a fair bit. Do you really think that it is to do with being a woman? Do you think that?
I think there's an aspect to it. I think there certainly is an aspect.
To the gatekeeping aspect of it. I mean, yeah. I think it's quite a gatekeepery thing anyway.
Yeah.
But most hobbies are, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like, try going down your local park with a boat you've made yourself and see if they let you in the club.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there would be an element of not wanting new people, really.
Yeah, or at least you'd have to pay your membership fee and get the right badge to be able to take your little trawler on the boating lake.
But do you know what I mean in terms of, like, that I think sometimes once things are set...
Yes.
So if there's a fictional ghost hunting group, right, mm-hmm. and it's led by Brian,
mm-hmm.
and Brian's put together a group of people. Now, Brian's in charge of it, mm-hmm. but he's also got his mate Ken, who also gets involved.
Yeah.
There's Doris and Sandra, who are also mm-hmm. involved in it as well. And everyone sort of knows their place in it because the hierarchy has been established.
Yeah.
So if someone then turns up to that group, there'd be an element of, well, this is our group. We've got all our component parts now.
Yeah.
So someone coming in might be a challenge to the alpha within it, might be a, you know...
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe Doris has got a crush on Ken, but then when Terry comes in, she's got eyes for Terry, and that causes all manner of upheaval in it. You know, there's all these things.
Yes.
All these weird sociological reasons that can...
Yeah. Of course, I think, like, with anything where there's a social group, there will always be differing dynamics. But I do think in certain aspects of the paranormal, again, not all ghosties, there is this kind of reticence to acknowledge that women have something to contribute. So as a kind of acknowledgement of that and a kind of pushback against that, that's where you get things like the Feminine Macabre Journal, you know, that are all female and non-binary writers just trying to make sure that these people have a voice within the paranormal.
Yeah.
You know,
and you write in as well.
Yeah, I've been in a few volumes of it.
Pretending you talk about discussion things, but actually selling your wares.
I don't get any money from that, so it is a good read, though. I would recommend buying them. And I do know of many female investigators and people who write for paranormal outlets who have been on the receiving end of some really horrible gender-focused attacks.
Yeah, I'm not saying... I'm very aware of how I said it when I said to you, do you really think that's the case, is how I phrased it. And I'm not actually doubting it. I just,
I've got no idea.
Because how would I know? How can I possibly know? Other than observing it. And as I'm not party to these groups anyway, I wouldn't even be able to observe it. In fact, the only person that I could ask about it is you.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm so sorry.
Well, no, you're the only lass that I know who's connected to the esoteric world, who isn't ingrained within a gang already.
Mm.
So I'm not doubting it. I'm asking, I suppose. But I also think, maybe with psychics, maybe it's just not quite as bad, or maybe it is, I don't know. But, you know, like, even going back to, like, Doris Stokes and people like that, you know, that these are people that forged a great career who were women.
Yeah.
They didn't seem to be excluded from the community anyway.
But
they were...
Visually... They all, like, Doris Stokes, Ina Twigg, Doris Collins, all the sort of polyester mediums, as I call them, from that era when they were all caftans and big bouquets of flowers. They all looked like your nana. They were all non-threatening.
Okay, well, the Fox sisters were young lasses.
Yeah, they had their fair share of abuse, though, didn't they?
Yeah, no, I'm not doubting that, but they weren't excluded from it. But I suppose with the Fox sisters, there was no community to be excluded from.
They created it, exactly.
I suppose.
I mean, even today, if a friend of mine put a post up on social media a while ago about semi-rising misogyny in the paranormal, and she just put a post up saying, you know, we should also acknowledge that arguably the first paranormal investigator, as we know it, was a woman called Catherine Crowe. And that...
Yeah, you said about her before.
Yeah, caused a whole manner of upheaval and abuse sent her way. So there's definitely something not right there.
Yeah.
A few last comments from PJ saying that it seems like an arms race in the paranormal to be offering or chasing the most scary and fearful experiences. And it's funny how ghosts often mirror aspects of the character of the people who chase them. So dinner ladies chase and encounter petty and vindictive ghosts or have a protective mothering role. Bother boot boys chase and encounter big, powerful, clever and well-armed, brackets, not in that way, demons. None of the weak grey lady stuff for them. And that's a really interesting point, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. But can I say also as a side point here that dinner ladies doesn't mean exclusively women. I know we say dinner ladies, but that's just
it's a gender neutral term. Yeah, it's a gender neutral term.
Yeah, for that kind of people.
Yes.
They're not all women at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the... Which we probably should have explained months ago. Really? But yeah.
Yeah, that was a really great point.
I mean, it's understandable. The first point of that comment is understandable.
Mm.
If you're trying to make an impression within an already oversaturated community, then it makes sense to make yours more extreme.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you and I both have a possibly abnormal love of ghost trains, of fairground rides. And I recall a few years ago when Darren Brown made a ghost train.
Mm.
I think it was at Thorpe Park or somewhere like that, wherever it was.
Yeah.
And there was a lot made of that, that it was the most frightening ghost train anywhere. Now, you and I both know, and I think most people, if you thought about it, would know, you haven't got much competition there, really.
No.
Ghost trains, generally speaking, aren't frightening. They're not.
No.
They're not even really trying to be. You know, really, I suppose the most famous ghost train in the world would be potentially the Haunted Mansion at Disney Parks. And it's not frightening.
That's just quite twee, really, isn't it?
It's atmospheric and it's gothic and it has contrary themes within it because of the way that it was actually originally designed, but that's a whole other story for another time, because I could talk about that for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
But it's funny and scary. It's both things, and it jars. It changes its theme halfway through because there were two different designers working on it and they couldn't come up with a consensus for it. But even the scary bits of it aren't scary. It's suitable for little kids. So ghost trains, really, their raison d'etre isn't really to be scary. In reality, they might say all spooks and thrills and chills and all that, but they're in fairgrounds which are predominantly populated by children, and if you had a ghost train that literally terrified people, there'd be no one in it. Like, parents wouldn't allow the kids in it. They'd be like, no, you're not going to traumatize my kids for life. But the Darren Brown thing, when that came out, I recall that being a big deal made of how traumatic it would be. Now, from all accounts, it isn't, but it's more immersive than other ghost trains. I think they use VR. I think there's quite a lot of that involved in it.
So okay.
I guess it perhaps feels more immersive, more like you're in something
that
they can do grander things with because it's CGI, I guess. Again, I'm talking about something that I've only heard hearsay of. I've never actually been on the ride myself. But from a marketing point of view, that makes sense to make it more frightening than other ghost trains. Ergo, you should come to this, because this is now the epitome of ghost trains, would be their claim. So it does actually make business sense. You know, if we put ethics aside, it makes business sense to be more extreme.
Yeah, if you're consistently finding demons and the worst of the undead, then, you know, you'll get more interest in whatever you're doing online, certainly.
Yeah, as opposed to, oh, did you hear that tap then?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it from that point of view.
Yeah. Well, Tango thinks he might have cracked it. Assuming there's an afterlife and communication with those in it is possible with spirit boards, it was all chill, lovely and sombre before the 80s. Since then, it's become this big, angry, violent spectacle. Have ghost botherers considered switching out their A, B, C, D, E, F spirit boards for QWERTY ones? I'm not saying I'm correct, but I would be a violent entity if I was constantly bothered by folks in matching embroidered fleeces demanding I talk to them about using a stupid keyboard format I, naughty word, hated.
Right, okay, well that's, you know, it'll slow them down. That's the idea of the keyboard, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was to slow down fast typists in the olden days.
I mean, it's a good idea, Tango, but you don't want your spirit board to get clogged up by spirits typing too quickly. But maybe you'd get more modern ghosts and faster ghosts who would then be, conversely, very familiar with the QWERTY format. So,
are there modern ghosts, though? Is that a thing?
Well, there's just as many reports of modern ghosts as there are, you know, Victorian chimney sweeps.
Are there, though?
They're just not as exciting. Yeah, yeah, constantly.
Of people that have just died, as in last week.
Yes.
There are as many of them as there are of people from Victorian times.
Yeah, except the Victorian ones sound a lot more exciting. It's more impressive to say, I saw them and they were in a bustled gown, rather than I saw them and they were in a Reebok tracksuit.
Isn't that a consideration within this, in certainly in the debunking of it in the skeptic world?
Oh yeah, there's always...
Isn't one of the arguments that there aren't modern ghosts?
There are no... Why are there no modern ghosts? Why are there no dinosaur ghosts? Why are there no this ghost? And it's, you know, there are reports...
Why do you feel
reports...
the need to give the skeptics a... upsetting voice? Why do you
I don't
need
know.
To
I don't...
deride them in that way?
No, because I don't feel like that's a sceptical argument.
Okay.
I feel like that's just the easy argument of, like, when it comes around to Easter and people will always be online saying, oh, well, actually, did you know it's pagan roots? It's like, everyone with a computer knows this. You're not offering anything new and exciting. So saying, oh, there are no ghosts because I haven't seen a Brontosaurus, is just, it's a bit hack.
Is it also a bit watertight?
Well, no, not if you live in this strange world of books that I do, where I can recommend a book called The Soul of Things that talks quite extensively about dinosaur ghosts. It was published in the 19th century.
I think you said something in the middle of that, which was it's often the easiest argument, but I think, as a generalisation, I think sceptic arguments often are the easiest argument because they're the least fussed, they're the least complicated, and that's often... the most direct and best way of challenging something is when you actually bring it back to the real world and just simplify it and say, this does not make sense.
Oh,
never mind all the things you're saying. If you look at this in simple, common sense, what you're saying makes no sense.
Yeah, oh, I'm not saying that because it's a simple argument, it should be discredited. It's just that as a simple argument presented as if it's groundbreaking or, oh, I've got you here, when you're yourself not especially immersed in the argument, I find quite frustrating.
Okay. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, thank you for all your comments. Keep them coming, by all means. We enjoy chatting about them, as you can hear, and we enjoy corresponding back with you, but with our voices. Neither of us like typing. Once again, I'll tell you what, I thought that the comments would be much shorter this week. I thought we would have a bit of breathing space, but once again, I can see your little favourite section getting bumped again. Because I'm looking forward greatly to today's discussion. To give the listener a heads up behind the scenes, before we started doing loopholes, there was a document being passed back and forward that has now ended up just being a photo from Kate's notice board.
Yeah, very high tech.
Lots of topics just written down in pen. And I, this week, happened to notice something that I hadn't noticed it on there before, but it said, sex magic.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is, but I don't care what it is. Because when we were talking about what the topic was going to be this week, I thought, oh, let's have a blue episode. We can do a blue one all about sexy stuff. Let's do sex magic. And I'll learn what sex magic is, because I genuinely don't know what it is. Genuinely don't know. And also, we'll have the added bonus of both my Patreon and your Patreon. The post will be flagged up for pornographic content when we write sex magic in the post, because Patreon is... puritanical in the extreme for some reason.
Yes. Really, I am constantly flagged up.
Well, that's because you talk about a lot of places which are something come something.
Yeah, it's constant. Lovely, wholesome. Like, look at these graves at something come Maltby, and it's like, oh no, it's filth, Kate. Yeah. It's filth.
So, because you write down CUM, it flags it up as pornographic content. So, sex magic. Genuinely a little bit excited here. First and foremost, not like that. First and foremost, a bit like that, actually. First and foremost, sex magic. Give me the headlines, please.
Right. Broadly speaking, sex magic is any ritual magic or ceremony where sexual activity in any form is used.
Okay.
And I don't know why I even included this in the list.
Yeah.
Because I'm fully aware that my mother listens to this podcast.
Right, okay. But I presume your mother has had sex?
Only twice, and she hated it both times.
Okay, but she will have, you know, so she'll be aware of it as a thing.
I like to think that she's gone past that now. She's really deep into her knitting.
Well, let's set some parameters straight off.
Okay.
Because of my lack of understanding of this, mm-hmm. of sex magic. You know, this is called loopholes. What mm-hmm. loopholes would be looking for within this? What would be the things that would be inconsistent within it? Or do you want to just leave that to me to react?
Let's leave it to you. Because I think there's a couple of interesting people that we should have a look at. And I'd like for both yours and the listeners' views on the nature of these magical rituals.
What are they trying to do, these little sexy rituals? What are they trying to do?
Most sex magic, as we know it today, broadly comes from Aleister Crowley, who was a very famous British occultist, who is really kind of ingrained within British popular culture from like the 60s onwards. You know, even Black Sabbath wrote a song about him. But most simple sex magic involves kind of harnessing that feeling, that sense of arousal or conclusion.
Right.
Combining it with a sense of like visualization as a means of...
I wish this was a video podcast. I really wish people could see how much you're struggling with talking about this. You're normally pretty confident.
I really
something's
am.
Happened here. Where you're, and by the way, if you talk about rude stuff in real life, you're not like this. Yeah. So why have you gone ultra coy now?
Because my mum's listening.
Is that literally all it is? You feel like you're having this discussion in front of your mum?
I do.
Well, just tell your mum she can't listen to this one and then speak openly.
Right, mum, can you
talking
get
about
out?
Conclusions?
I'm trying to be a nice guy. I mean, we don't swear in this, so I'm trying to not be too crude, but it's certainly going to be hard when we get into the story a bit. There's no way I can get through this. This is ridiculous.
I just remember something. Mm. I just had a flash memory just come into my head. Many, many years ago, I mean, we're talking like 20 years ago now, something. I was going out with a lass, and on her bookshelf, there was a book, which who knows, might have been an Aleister Crowley thing, I don't know. I didn't mm-hmm. even recall what it was about. But it was mm-hmm. some sort of witchcraft spell sort of thing. And within that book, I just skimmed through it, and within that book, there was a thing about how to get people to be attracted to you. If you had your eye on someone, how mm-hmm. to remotely get them to fancy you or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or to, you know, to feel a sexual attraction to you. Mm-hmm. And that was all about like shouting people's name really loud at the point of conclusion and all that. Sort of like... kind of basic spells of putting it out there into the universe kind of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of it. It's at the point of conclusion.
Which she probably did with me, to be honest with you, because I can't think of any other reason why I ever went out with her.
But no, it's all about, harnessing that ultimate point of sensation and power and using it to manifest what you want and seeing that as a magical power.
Okay, well then here's loophole number one from my perspective. Again. Okay. Not even heard anything about it properly yet. But what I will say is that the act of sexual interaction, copulation, however you wish to discuss mm-hmm. it, even onanism, you know, just however mm-hmm. it happens, the point of, as Kate beautifully puts it, conclusion, is biologically designed to feel powerful. That's within you biologically. That's mm-hmm. not anything to do with the heart in terms of love or emotion mm-hmm. or any of those things. It is a biologically designed thing to make you want to do it more in order to continue the species. That's what it is.
Yes.
And I think regardless of what anyone thinks about anything else, we could probably broadly agree on that mm-hmm. that is infused into us biologically.
Yes.
As a result of that, that moment, it feels like another plane. It feels otherworldly in a sense to how you would actually feel in normal life, just going about your day-to-day business. That point, whether privately or shared or whatever it is, has a feeling of immense power, but it's biological. It's been put into you biologically. So it would stand to reason that that would then be adopted by people who have more esoteric, literally,
mm-hmm.
views of the world.
Yes.
As something that is magical.
Yeah, and then can actually make your soul transcend.
Yeah.
So a lot of sex magic involves not just the conclusion, but the sustained usage of the feeling of pleasure and prolonging that right. and utilising that in magical ritual.
Yeah.
And sex magic has developed over centuries. It wasn't just a kind of free love 60s thing. It actually has its roots in the Victorian era, in the 19th century, with a man called Pascal Beverly Randolph, who was born in 1825. So we're going back quite a long way.
Well, he's not going to get laid any other way, is he? He'd have to, magic, mate.
He's a fascinating man. Oh, here comes Pascal man.
Beverly Randolph again. Such a ladies' man. You big fop. Get out of here.
But he wasn't necessarily a big fop, because he was American.
Yeah.
He was a mixed race gentleman at that time as well. So his dad was a very powerful Virginia governor, and his mum was a black enslaved woman.
Okay.
And he was incredibly well educated, mainly self-educated.
Right.
And so when he started travelling the world writing about sex magic as a very confident, enterprising, mixed race man, he was the most subversive man in sort of 19th century erotica and esoterotica in the 19th century. And so he made a lot of enemies and also steered clear of a lot of big movements. So you'd think, for example, he'd be really involved with spiritualism, but not really, because his beliefs about controlling, ironically, who you let in and what you let into yourself didn't really align with spiritualist values of letting spirits channel through you whenever they wanted.
So was he unpopular?
He was a popular bloke, really. And there was no one like him. So as much as he was a staunch occultist, he was also an abolitionist.
Right.
So he was a very strong-minded man. And he was also kind of this mixed-race man who, you know, created his own elixirs to try and earn a living. That's also what kind of discredited a lot of his stuff.
Okay.
But he was ultimately, if you pardon the pun again, kind of the daddy of sex magic.
Right.
And he was hugely influential in developing ideas of sex magic that were then later stolen, reattributed, or built on by Western white occultists.
Okay.
So there's a lot of really unsteady race relations there. But he put forward the idea that conclusion is kind of the most powerful experience that a human can have, because, like you said earlier, the soul transcends and the soul moves into divine realms.
Can we really not say orgasm on this podcast? Is that really
beyond I just felt like I'd...
To say orgasm?
I felt like I'd set the bar, you know, and it was just, well, I've committed to conclusion now. I've got to continue.
That happens. Kate, can you
I'm sorry.
Say orgasm for me, please?
I will when it next comes up in my mind, and I won't say conclusion, I promise. Okay. But I need to quote Pascal. Blimey.
That really is one, isn't it?
Yeah. So Pascal said that, quote, true sex power is God power.
Right.
So orgasms, see, Kate said it, well done. Oh, I feel dirty. <It's a> bit... can be harnessed, like this power can be harnessed for, you know, spiritual gain, but also personal gain. So, you know, as much as you might come to conclusion and say, oh, I want to be loved, or, oh, I want to have millions of children and be successful at work, you can also use that power for physical, tangible things like, oh, I want a Corsa. And then the next day, because of sex magic, you get in a new car.
Yeah.
He also has boundaries of women's involvement.
Right, okay.
The landscape in which you conduct your sex magic. So there were many requirements as to what makes a suitable woman for use in sex magic.
Okay.
All this is kind of focused more towards the man utilising sex magic. So it was meant to be, ideally, a married heterosexual couple of personal, mental and moral cleanliness.
Okay.
There was all these sort of very, what we'd see as traditional Victorian values imposed on something that seems very non-traditional for the time. And for the best magic, the most powerful magic of all, where you've pretty much got a certainty of getting what you want, is for both partners to reach orgasm at once.
Right.
So he was a big idealist in that sense.
Right, okay.
And so he kind of laid the foundations for the sex magic that came after that.
Is this about getting laid and getting people to open up sexually and potentially be less inhibited? Is it the magic side of it that's important? So is it to get things? Is it to actually have a power of acquiring stuff by doing your rudies?
Yeah.
Or is it just a faddy thing that was going on at that time? I suppose a sort of emancipation, really.
I think certainly emancipation comes into it, definitely. But I believe that, judging by a lot of occultist writing at that time, movements like Rosicrucianism and things like that.
What's that?
It was people that believed that there was this kind of esoteric, unseen knowledge and force that we just hadn't tapped into yet. When we couple this with the moving spiritual movement, the enormous technological advances that were made during this era, and of course the enormous scientific advances as well, to then think we could harness energy and sexual energy as something that we can use ourselves wouldn't be too great a leap when you look at the environment at the time. So I think it is all of those things. You know, it's getting your rocks off, it's empowering yourself, and it's also manifesting and celebrating the power of the self as well. And also your connection with God, if you chose to take sex magic in that direction.
Well, there's a few things going on in my head at the moment where I'm thinking about, beyond the sort of the affectation of schoolboy humour that I've adopted at certain points in this so far, there's also, as I think ahead with this, there's a weaponization of sexuality that exists to this day. In fact, I would strongly suggest that we are in a new puritanical movement at the moment from people who you would have expected to have been the ones who were about free love, quote-unquote. You know, there seems to be, certainly amongst the trendy brigade, if you like, a quite alarming puritanical streak, I find. So when discussing elements of people's sexuality or sexual preference or what they actually indulge in behind closed doors or what have you, you know, quite a judgmental thing that appears to be kind of harking back to the bad old days is how I would see it. So there's a long history of your sexuality and your sexual activity being used to beat you around the head, as it were, you know, being used as attack, you know, to sort of undermine. Simultaneous to that as well, again, I'm hypothesizing here because I don't know if this is the actual case, because I don't know anything about it, but I suspect there would be able to be lines drawn from this very early movement of this, potentially tangible lines drawn to sex cults, things that I think most people would generally agree, where sex is a controlling thing.
Yes,
would generally agree that's not a good thing. You know, how many, like, second comings, again, pardon the pun, but how many people who proclaim to be Jesus or whoever or some sort of messiah have ended up having multiple wives and multiple sexual partners in their compound and all that sort of thing? You know, that's pretty, the ten a penny them, or they have been over the years. So I imagine the attitude of kind of free love, sexual expression, you know, being at one with yourself and, if you choose to think of it that way, with God or spirit or whatever it is, there will be a line to be able to be drawn through that. It's sort of like a gateway drug, do you know what I mean? It's sort of like, if you have if you have a spliff, you might end up addicted to heroin, you know, it's like,
yeah, do sex magic and you might end up as a cult leader.
Yeah, so I'm now concerned, after being giddy about talking about this, I'm now concerned at the darker aspects of this, where, you know, where that journey may have gone through the years. Yeah. So if Pascal was are we saying he was the first one that was like,
it's kind of yeah, flouncing the originator
about the place with his big cuffs.
Yeah, and it's his ideas that have kind of disseminated through to like contemporary-ish sex magic. So he put a lot of the foundations in place. But I think the journey of sex magic as a whole would have gone in maybe more extreme directions had it happened at a later time. Maybe, because certainly, because a lot of this is happening in the 19th century, you've got, again, rising puritanical, like, Christian denominations, you've got, especially in America, you've got the Comstock laws, which were very strict obscenity laws that came in and were enforced quite viciously, you know, across the sex magic, growing sex magic movement, the occultist movement, and certainly the spiritualist movement.
So what were those laws? What were they against? What was it? What were they banning?
They were mainly based against obscenity, kind of anything, any writing to do with free love, sexuality, anything that didn't fit the ideas of that time and the ideas of the men who instigated those laws. And the penalties for saying certain things about sexuality and about sex were really severe. A lot of women were made real examples of and were put into prison for several years at a time for even just publishing an article on their sexuality.
Was this just women or primarily
women? I would say primarily women. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Because that was seen as like the ultimate affront to what a good society should be. A sexually awakened woman is a dangerous woman. And a woman in control or a woman in power is a dangerous woman. And so a woman in control of powerful sexuality is a ticking time bomb.
That goes on to this day, doesn't it? Like, there's a lot of dismissive... Well, do you know what I'm going to quote? I'm going to quote Twilight.
Oh, okay.
Is what I'm going to quote, which is something that I haven't seen. Yet. I haven't seen, or were they books originally?
Yes. Yeah, series of books by Stephanie Meyer.
I am unaware of them. I couldn't tell you the story of it or anything like that. What I am aware of, though, is the reaction given to that franchise by, as far as I can see, exclusively men.
Mm-hmm.
Who would be very derisory about that as you know, either like, oh, it's not a good vampire story, or it's not, you know, it's for teenage girls and stuff. And as Ewan McGregor once very famously said, since when was the opinion of teenage girls to be dismissed?
Yeah.
You know, it's for them, so that's fine.
Yeah.
So I think that mood perhaps has never left us, and I say us as in society, I don't mean you and I.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I believe is at its core, and you will be able to tell me better than this, because you're a goth, so it's, you know, the equivalent of water to you, Twilight, I would imagine. But what is about the expression of female sexuality within it.
Yeah.
The girls in that story, the fact that they are... freely exploring their sexuality. Is that correct?
To an extent, but it's... I mean, Twilight was written by, as far as I remember, a Mormon woman called Stephanie Meyer. And so within the confines of this kind of romantic, I think it's quadrilogy, it ultimately, spoilers, by the way, does end in the natural conclusion of this relationship is marriage and the sanctification of that relationship, even though... one of them's 400 years old, you know, and the other one's about to be. So I think Twilight in particular, as you well know, is like a real passion point for me, because I've certainly subjected you to many late night calls when I've said, I've heard this person saying Twilight's saying, oh, so-and-so is still a better love story than Twilight. My vampires don't sparkle. When really, it's just an attack on teenage girls.
And is it? So it's that... You know, would you take that? Yeah, I think you would. You would take that attack, wouldn't you? Because once again on this podcast, I'm talking about something that I don't actually know the details of. I am just observing it from outside and putting two and two together and making hopefully four. But is that the case?
I would take that tack, but that's my personal, quite voracious opinion on Twilight. Yeah. But I'm also not going to sit here and say, by the way, these are the most beautiful, evocative, classically written books. You know, they are genre fiction for teenage girls. And in my opinion, as far as genre fiction for teenage girls goes, they are brilliant. It is a brilliant series. And I have a copy of the Twilight books and the Twilight films. I appreciate them for what they are. But then attacking a franchise or a series of anything when you're not its target market...
a middle-aged man slagging off Twilight is quite a tragic situation, isn't it? Really?
It is. It's just a bit pathetic, really. You know, I'm going to slam on what my child likes. Like, oh, aren't you the big man?
Yeah, but that's not something that's like... I mean, most parents do that. In fact, that is the fuel for the kids liking the thing oftentimes, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose.
It's stuff that your parents don't like. Carmilla is another example of that, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, the Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, yeah.
Which is an olden days book.
Yeah, tiny isn't olden it? Days book off of the past.
Where women have the audacity to enjoy sex within it, is that right?
Well, it was... uninitiated, it's a tiny novella where female vampirism is depicted with having very strong sapphic themes.
Hmm.
There's some instances of female-on-female vampirism being seen as quite a sexual act, and the language being used is very close to that that would have been used to depict orgasms and the peak of sexual pleasure. Right. But between two girls.
Is that relevant in what we're talking about, bringing that up? Well, is that actually relevant?
It's certainly the literal demonisation of female sexuality. So there's something very ungodly about a sexually awakened woman. So then when Pascal Beverly Randolph passed on and ideas of sexuality and sexology and sex magic developed and more women took the helm of the movement... People right. like Ida Craddock. We're still in the 19th century here.
Wasn't she a chef? Who am I thinking of? What, who was
you're
the
thinking,
chef? What
you're
was
thinking
her first name?
Fanny.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I knew what it was. I just made you to say Fanny and your mum's listening.
Sorry, Mum. So people like Ida Craddock, no relation to Fanny. Yeah,
except at weekends.
Push this this sexual movement that was kind of a bit of a popular phase in the 19th century called Dionysism, you know, named after the goddess Diana, who ironically was the goddess of chastity. So
okay, you
know, work that one out.
Probably an in-joke, innit?
Yeah. Dionysism was basically getting sexual, spiritual, magical fulfillment and pleasure without, let's say, the need for conclusion or kind of without fear of conception.
Okay.
That's quite interesting that it's kind of a magical contraceptive method.
How was its hit rate? Would it be now retrospectively considered to have been a most effective form of contraception?
No.
Are there links to that and tantric sex and that sort of stuff? Is
definitely.
It
things
kind
like
gig, yeah.
Tantric and something that was called like coitus reservatus. I mean, that's pretty self-explanatory, just prolonging and holding off.
And what's the magic aspects of that? So what's the magic? Well, what does it do?
There's harnessing the power of pleasure.
Besides really annoying. Yeah. So what would it do? What would the power be?
So there's aspects that are quite odd, really, that are to engage in Dionysism. You should really see your sexual partner not as a physical body, but as a manifestation of your guardian angel. So the whole process itself of intercourse is a deeply spiritual experience, the power of which can then be harnessed. And it's the power of focus and of restraint. And although a lot of this was written by women, a lot of it was focused towards male restraint. But Ida, who I mentioned earlier, she never married, but she had a long-term relationship with an angel, and she had sex with this angel where it was so loud that neighbours made repeated noise complaints.
So we know what she was doing, don't we?
Yeah.
So out of all the claims of this being a powerful thing, I mean, I'm not saying that it wouldn't be powerful in your head, that it wouldn't feel powerful.
Yeah.
But for all the claims of, like, the book that I mentioned earlier on, like, what's the hit rate of these things? Would you say there's something in it that, you know, you could utilise your sexual feelings and the power of those to actually, quote, do magic?
I mean, it seems like
I didn't
like
mean
a
to say
of...
that as derisory as I just said it.
Yeah.
I didn't actually mean to say it that way. I know that sounded surly and I didn't mean it to be like that. So I'll say it straight. Do you think there's credibility to the claim that how you conduct yourself sexually or sexual rituals or whatever, this, that and the other, can make magic? Even that sounded a bit surly.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of prep for me. Okay. I think this reads a lot like manifestation energy. You know when people say, you ask the universe, you project those thoughts out to the universe and then the universe will provide, that sort of mindset. Yeah.
I mean, what would you put credibility into that as well, because my take on that, all that sort of thing, has always been it's just adjusting your attitude to things. So
I think it's the power of positive thinking.
But it's not actually magical. It's not actually the universe isn't sorting you out. You're sorting yourself out, you know. You're formalizing your own thoughts and you're focusing your own efforts by believing that if I write it down here and write it down there and then set fire to it and blow it into the wind, that the universe shall deliver. And my take on that is, no, you've not understood what you've actually done by accident. You've just formulated your own thoughts. You've focused your own energies and it's now to do with the universe. It's you. I mean, I think there's potentially, I think I might have, again, pardon the pun, shot my bolt a bit early on this, because I think, going back to what I said about the biological feeling and the powerful biological feeling that is written into our DNA is why it feels powerful.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Because it's an inexplicable feeling of power and of force.
Yeah.
That, again, if you're already in the mindset of I have the power to harness energies, then it all fits in quite nicely. And I think all of this kind of relates to how Alan Moore, the writer and artist, speaks about magic when he says that all magic is real and powerful and has effect as long as you remember that it's all happening inside your own head.
Right,
I think maybe sex magic has got a lot. It kind of ties into that quite nicely.
That's why Alan Moore's a more creative person than me, and that's why he will always be forever more successful, dramatically more successful than me, because he can come up with a phrase like that.
Yeah.
Whereas I go, it's just biology, isn't it? It's just your biology that makes you feel like that. I can't write gift cards, mate.
No. So that was Loopholes, the blue episode. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, I wanted it to be, but it went all dark.
Well, it's your fault. I was keeping it all, ooh, sex magic, and you were all, oh, cool.
I was just sat here going, I can't think of anything for Elvis to say. No.
I wanted to have a nice chat about Victorians doing blueies, and you're all in it about, ooh, moral conflict. Every week, I can't get my filth out there because of you and me mother, and it's getting old.
I think it's important to let the listener know that Cynthia and the King have been here all the time, but they're both just sat in the corner blushing. Particularly Simply, weirdly. For someone with his claimed track record, you'd have thought he'd be a bit more open.
So if you want to get in touch, please do. You can do so by leaving a comment on either of our Patreons at patreon.com/burialsandbeyond for me, patreon.com/IanBaldsworth for him. And you can find us on Facebook at Loopholes Podcast, Instagram at Loopholes Pod, Twitter at Loopholes Pod, and you can even send us an email at loopholespodcast@gmail.com.
And we're also going to set up a sex magic club on the Facebook page as well.
Yeah, and patrons do get their special club cards. So if you want that little laminated bit of fun.
You won't be allowed. You won't be allowed.
Okay.
Honestly, I've been told.
Right, Facebook sex club. Come on, I'll buy a laminator and we'll have a lovely time.
Thank you for joining us. I've been Ian Bolesworth.
And I've been Kate Cheryl.
For God's sake, say Dr. Kate Cheryl.
I've been Dr. Kate Cheryl.
Give this some academic clout, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Loopholes is an Infinite Hermit production in association with Burials and Beyond, with Kate Cheryl and Ian Bolesworth. Music by Thomas Funderay, produced by Ian Bolesworth.